There's a couple other questions from the panel, but we've opened the four issues that the panel decided were really critical for tonight. And I hope that there are some questions circulating that you've written as you've listened that we can now begin to feed in and offer to the panel. So if you have got some questions, please write them and signal to Sean or to Shana that you are wanting to put a question in that form to them. I've got a couple of questions that have come in relation to the asylum seeker issue, so I'm going to return to that issue now because these questions have come for the floor. The first one is, will any of the major parties, or any of the parties here, sorry, commit themselves to processing asylum seekers in metropolitan centres on mainland Australia within the next 3 years? Libby, I heard you quite emphatically say that Green's policy was to do that, but there's a challenge for the other three parties, and I'm just going to invite, it's only a 30-second response, it's really a yes or a no with perhaps a sentence or two of comment about your answer. So Claire, then Brett, then Wendy.
It's not our policy.
I beg your pardon?
It's not our policy.
And do you want to just one sentence say why?
We've explained that in terms of the process, we're looking at an international response and we're looking at processing in terms of a regional response, not on mainland Australia.
Thanks, Claire. Brett?
Similar from the coalition and of course adopting a UNHCR guidelines as the appropriate law to be followed in the resolution of those applications.
That's what we want. Rural Australia with hostel type accommodation.
Okay. So you're supporting the question?
Yes.
Mainland processing within 3 years?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's a second question on asylum seekers that I might actually put as well. The question is, why does the coalition persist in calling asylum seekers illegal immigrants or acting illegally? I'm not sure that, Brett, your party is the only one that might do that, and maybe not everyone in your party does it anyway. It's certainly part of the political jargon, though. We talk about illegal immigrants or queue jumpers. But this questioner asks, please name the laws which they break by crossing a border without a visa. So maybe we might just get the legality question addressed first. And Brett, I will actually ask you to do that. In what sense are they illegal immigrants?
Well, you can't just cross into another country without permission. I mean, there are no open borders. But in a sense, refugees are an exception to that rule, if that makes sense.
Yep.
I mean, I can't just walk into another country just because I want to go there. The world doesn't work like that, without a visa. The exception is if I'm a refugee. So in a sense, when people arrive by boat or indeed by aircraft, which either way, the assumption with people coming by boat is that it's illegal technically in the sense that prima facie it's illegal because they don't have a visa or permission to enter the country. Does anyone follow that? On the face of it, it is. And then when they approve, as indeed, Camilla, you said this, many prove refugee status, and I accept that. Then, of course, the exception is proven, and there's nothing illegal about their conduct.
Okay. The next question is, under the Howard government... I'm sorry, Claire, I do apologise.
The point is that the media has actually picked up on that term, and I think you're quite right in that it's not a term that Bert uses, and I've not heard you use it anyway, Bert.
But
in terms of process, the discussion and the debate must be about the role of asylum seekers, and we try very strenuously to maintain that terminology. But if you open the newspaper or you listen to the radio, what happens is you hear the alternate, and that's the real sadness that's happened in this debate, that because of things that have occurred, there's this community thing, and I know that one of the things we must do is actually have ongoing community education. And I think that that's one of the core challenges to no matter which party you're in. But the question actually reflects the stuff that you see in the media.
Thank you. Look, the final question I've got on that at the moment is also brief. Under the Howard government, temporary protection for confirmed real refugees kept families separated. Is this humane in keeping with the rights of the child, and will you really do it again?
Well, I mentioned before about our policy on temporary protection visas. They will be administered in accordance with international law.
So is the answer that it would be different from last time or the same as last time?
Well, it'll be administered in accordance with international law. I mean, that's all I can say. Well, I don't. I don't know more than that. I don't know more than that. But I can say that if you're asking whether it will be legal, yes, it will be.
Well, I think the question really is it humane? And does it respect the rights of the child?
Well, hold on.
It's illegality, maybe.
Well, someone said, well, hold on. I said before, I think, and I wasn't trying to mislead anyone, that the coalition will be following UNHCR guidelines. Now, you can dispute whether we're going to do that, but that's our policy, that we will be following international law and the convention. The difference is, because it's offshore processing, Australian domestic law will not be applied.
Okay. Just trying to make sure that...
Is it humane, Brett? That was the rider. Do you consider it humane to keep families separated?
Is all law humane? Probably not.
Okay, we're going to go to climate change. A question, Brett, to you again, but I'm going to invite the others to comment as well. Brett Mason quotes us as producing 1.5% of emissions and we're taking less than 0.1% of refugees. Why does our nation punch above our weight in causing problems but underperform in solving them?
Australia takes 13,750 refugees per year. And I'm sure Claire will confirm this. We receive more refugees per capita than any other nation on earth. Yes, we do. That's a fact.
But Wendy, do you want to make a comment?
Clearly, when you have as large an immigration program as Australia does, there's room there for us to be doing more in terms of refugees. And that's essentially our immigration policy, which would be to direct a greater proportion towards asylum seekers and family reunions and away from the skilled migration, which is being used to de-skill Australia or not pay for the true skilling of Australia. And of course, the other problem with our skilled migration program is that we're actually, in a sense, stealing the educated members of developing countries. So, you know, it's unfair at both ends. And so we think the balance should be shifted. And in that way, we could do much more towards our international responsibilities towards the world's refugee problem.
I think all I'd just say is that asylum seekers have already suffered enormous traumatic experiences in their own home country, so all we can do to make that least traumatic when they get here, the better.
Okay. Thank you. That introduced us to climate change. There's a question here. The questioner says, I first heard of climate change in 1988. Maybe some of us heard it even prior to that in different forms. Keating raised it in the mid-90s. The question says, why is Senator Mason and the Coalition so late and so slow in coming to the party? And there might be a second part to this in terms of why do the parties believe there is still no community consensus when clearly they have voted for parties with strong climate change policy? I might get Brett and Claire to respond to that, please.
The community consensus that people talk about depends on a couple of things. It is true, and it is true, that most Australians want action on climate change. That's true. That I accept. But if you ask them this question, should Australia act in the absence of action by our major overseas competitors, you know what most Australians say? No. They say no. That's the fact. Now... The dissonance, the distance between those two points is where we have to travel. I accept, and I'm not, as Claire knows, a climate change denier, and in fact most of the coalition isn't. Some are, but most aren't. Most people think in the coalition that we need to have an insurance policy, or what does Rupert Murdoch say? We should be giving the planet the benefit of the doubt. That would certainly be my view, without any doubt. But the distance between those... Most Australians think we should do something, that's true. But do most Australians believe that we should act before other nations act in concert with us? And if we do act, it will mean it will affect our standard of living and will not be in our national interest. No.
Claire, your comment on that?
I'm always worried by people who say that they're speaking for most Australians. It doesn't matter on what issue, because every poll that says one thing, someone who has a different view can produce an alternate poll that says the other. So it always concerns me when people say, I speak on behalf of most Australians. What was indicated in the extensive debate about climate change in the last period of government was that there is a difference of opinion in the community. There is not a genuine consensus, but I'm not sure whether there's a genuine consensus on anything in this country. I think people will always have different views, but what we saw was that people had significant concerns and worries, particularly when it came down to taking action. And when action impacted on economic change, that was when people were most outraged by the whole process. So we have a considerable job to do to actually bring people on side with it. But it scares me, as I said, David, when people speak on behalf of most Australians, because whilst people who feel that way can produce a poll, I have regular correspondents, and I know them well, to my office that can produce alternate polls and alternate very strongly and passionately believed statements that they think that there should be something different. So I don't believe there is an absolute consensus, as that question says, but I think I believe that there is a need to act, so it's our job in government to make sure that we bring people with us.
Marcus, we've covered this a little bit, but I'm going to ask Libby and Wendy for a brief comment in relation particularly to a commitment by the Australian people for action that may be costly. I mean, I think this is where the political heat is in this question.
Well, I mean, what's not being said is both major parties ran scared of the massive vested interests that the mining industry represents in this country. And they weren't prepared, and we saw that with the resources tax, mining resources super profits tax, and the Labor Party really felt, you know, the force of that industry when they suggested that. And that's exactly the issue that it was with climate change. As they've both said, there's a majority of members of both sides of Parliament who know climate change is real. And the environment movement has been saying this for 30 years. The renewables make sense. They make sense for ordinary people. They create jobs. They make us energy independent. They don't cause pollution. The only reason we are having this blockage is because there is so much money tied up by individuals who own coal mines and gas. And instead of being open and honest about it to get the climate change policy through, the government cowered. Both parties cowered over it. And that's been even more the case with the tax. They didn't want that huge advertising campaign waged against them. But the fact is, yeah, polling after polling showed that the majority of Australians supported action on climate change. And always, when you give people the options of renewable energy, they always say, yes, that makes sense. It's pollution-free. It's cheap in the long term. But instead, we let industry run scared. I mean, that's happening at the moment on the Darling Downs. I know I have to be quick, David.
Yep, yep.
But the reality is the coal seam gas people are saying, but we're bringing jobs. The state government's saying, we're bringing jobs. It means that we're going to lose long-term farming jobs and long-term soil production. Mm. You know, so in fact, they're rarely actually new jobs. Alternative energy will also produce lots of jobs, but the problem is there's no multinationals putting significant investment in it. It's all been small scale. The Chinese have put more into it than we have, so maybe soon we'll have the Chinese coming to Australia to sell us some of their renewable technology and promise us jobs, because until that happens and there's a rival power, because government will not take the initiative, we're going to be stuck in this crazy debate.
Wendy,
there's no doubt that we haven't looked after our world, but I don't think that the governments have done very well at educating us on the issues and how we can be responsible, and then the people might actually support some of their initiatives if they just understood them. I don't think we understand a lot of things. I think the average person doesn't. And if you see that the way that when we had the water crisis, it was very well explained and we all did our part, and look how good we did. We did so well when we understood what the issue was and we cut down our water usage and right across the state, and that was resolved. But I don't think that we're being explained to what we can actually do, and it's amazing what people can do if they understand. And as soon as we understood about the water, we responded and we did well. So we need the governments to stop playing the big games with their back and forward and the political games, and we need them to explain it so that we can actually respond.
Claire, can I ask you a 30-second response to this question? Why does climate change require a consensus when the intervention didn't? And perhaps to say, rather than just the intervention, at what point is leadership about gathering consensus and not taking hard decisions. I think that might be part of where that question is coming from. You've got a brief response.
It's a bit of both in terms of the responsibility of government. But a government that does not have a genuine understanding of the decisions they're making, whether you agree or not, is not doing their job. So I think it's one of those clever questions, and I think the same person who did those stats earlier could have asked that question in terms of comparing immigration and use of energy. But in terms of process, you need to actually ensure that the community knows what's happening and why, and that is good government. So I don't think it's a fair comparison with the intervention, because there was a whole range of things that went before, and I remind you it wasn't our government that did it. So just be very clear about that. In terms of process, I think there is a place for leadership, but leadership without understanding is not an effective community, I don't believe. It comes close to being an autocratic dictatorship. Because sometimes things that people impose do work, but is that the kind of community we want in our country? I don't think so.
That's okay. That's fine. I just want to change tack a little bit to schools, which is an issue we haven't yet covered, but someone has asked a question which I think is worth ventilating. They expressed the view, since the national curriculum under Labor has been so blandly disappointing... So there's the assumption, or there's the declaration. What would the coalition, if elected, do to ensure that it does become a 21st century curriculum for our schools? Brett.
Sure.
45 seconds, it's a new topic.
Well, the issue is still being ventilated. In fact, discussion is still going on about the content of the national curriculum. Can I say, Claire will be shocked to hear me say this, but I agree largely with what the government has done on the national curriculum. In other words, I think it's good to have a common curriculum throughout the country. Because I think it's good for standards to be similar. I think it's a good thing when people move into state. Australians are a very mobile people. I think it makes sense. The next issue, though... well, sir, even if assuming you're right, it's good to have what we might call world's best practice. All right. In other words, if we can get the best practice in the world adopted here in Australia, I think that's a good thing. The issue, however, and this is becoming tighter and tighter and tighter, is the assessment that's going to be adopted. You know, my view, and this is not the coalition's official view, but it's my personal view as spokesman on the issue, is that there should be common national assessment. Because that would, in a sense, standards therefore would become uniform. And Bob Carr, for example, believes in that. But I'll be honest, most educators in Queensland don't. They think their system is better. In New South Wales, they think their assessment system is better. And you know what? The Victorians think their assessment system is better. Just like the mental health. So at least I think, and this is where I do agree with the government, I think the idea, even if we can't get common national assessment, I think a common national curriculum is a very good thing in principle.
Can I? So let's then move on. There's another question here. What are the party's policies regarding state aid for religious schools? There's an easy topic to unpack briefly, with not much history behind it. I think we might, in fact, invite each of the four, because education and state support for private schools, religious schools, is a, you know, it's an emblematic issue of church-state relationships and so on. So we might invite from Claire down, and again, just a brief response so we can...
Julia released a policy yesterday in terms of reinforcing the fact that we will be supporting people's choice in education, and that will mean that there won't be extra money for private schools over public schools, but that anyone in the country, regardless of where they're going to school, provided they operate within the set curriculum and actually are providing an education that links to that, will be appropriately funded.
Also, just quickly make a comment on the previous question, which was that
yep.
You know, world's best practice is really damaging our education institutions, because what it means is, I mean, I see the way it operates at the university sector, and it's just an excuse for making things like Queensland studies and local studies irrelevant. And the pressure on university students these days is horrendous. Now we're going to make it all the way down to the primary school level. And so there is a connection between that question about assessment in schools and the very first questions, because all of this contributes to the mental health problems in our society, because every time you have winners at world best practice level, you have losers. And that's usually the majority of your society. And then you wonder why you have a massive problem with suicide and why people don't cope with modern society. It's because it's obsessed with competition, and it's appalling the personal effects that it has. On terms of funding for schools, the Greens' commitment is to needs-based funding for schools, the policy is in part a reaction against the excessive amounts that were made to the elite private schools under the Howard government years. And believe me, it's tragic to know the difference between the facilities at the elite boys' schools of Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and your average state school. And so we have a commitment. It doesn't matter what denomination or whether it's private or public, the commitment is to needs-based funding for the education system.
Brett Mason.
I would be reluctant to adopt your view on competition. I think competition has its place in every facet of society. It's how, so long as it's cooperative. No, not necessarily for six-year-olds, but NAPLAN, for example, the testing. I agree with NAPLAN. It's the national testing that, across Australia. It might be too much, and there's an argument whether there's too much of it, but do I think there should be national testing to determine how kids are progressing? Yes, I do. In terms of funding... I went to a Catholic primary school and then government schools my entire education. Increasingly, however, people are choosing to go to independent Catholic schools as opposed to state schools. That's their choice. And the coalition has said no school will be worse off.
Wendy?
Family First supports choice in education across the board. The problem I would have with the national curriculum is, are there going to be things that the national curriculum says that church schools, for instance, would have to teach that they would prefer not to teach, or if the sex education comes in, would that have to be taught? Is our children not going to be able to, our parents not going to have the right to be able to keep their children out of some things? That's the concerns I would have the national curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I've got a mental health question, and then we might have one more on human rights, and then invite you to wrap up. The mental health one is perhaps quite specific, but it is in relation to a Vietnam veteran who has ongoing support for PTSD, and they ask, if in ongoing support program, why is an annual referral required from a GP to maintain coverage or continue with a multi-year mental health support program? Now, Claire, do you want to...
In other forms of our payments, we're moving away from in terms of working with people who are ill, we're moving away from annual referrals. Within the particular area of PTSD at this stage in DVA, they're saying that it's a very important link between the ongoing health of the veteran, which is not just mental health, the ongoing health of the veteran linking into their mental health. Because one of the things they have established through the DVA process is that often people have a range of issues that all combine. So it's very rarely just the mental health aspects of the PTSD that need to be considered. So that at the moment is the linkage that there needs to be, and an understanding that the veteran should have the right, and does, to have that general checkup with their GP, part of which is their annual referral for their ongoing mental health support.
That's great. That's a good practical answer. I'm going to just have one more question here, which was one the panel didn't get to. Louis, you didn't need to respond to that? Yeah, okay. This is about human rights abuses. It actually picks up the war in Afghanistan, which is something we haven't even really talked about. So let's pick it up in the last few minutes of tonight, because it's a key issue. And this question is that much has been said in public discussion about asylum seekers in recent years and the role of people smugglers, and yet they are exploiting the desperation of people who are fleeing persecution from human rights abuses and dangerous situations, often at the hands of their own government. And so part of the solution must be the way in which Australia seeks to uphold and enforce human rights situations in countries, in source countries, where those rights are being abused. Would you make a comment firstly about the role Australia needs to play in places where there are severe conflict and persecution leading to the flight of people as refugees? And secondly, is the presence of forces in Afghanistan designed to decrease the human rights abuses which lead to people fleeing And if so, then what is happening in terms of the number of people who are continuing to flee from that country? So a couple of issues there, but I'd invite your responses. Wendy, how about we start with you, and we'll just move through the panel.
So the overall goal in Afghanistan has to be to build an independent and a democratic and stable Afghanistan. It's interesting when you talk to the soldiers themselves or even the families of the soldiers that they are totally committed to what their children are doing over there, and they believe in it. So that helps me believe in it because they do. But our goal is to build a stable Afghanistan so that people don't have to flee there to come here.
I think that's right, Wendy. And also, I think the initial motivation when the troops were initially sent there was to prevent Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That was the initial motivation. And the secondary motivation, of course, was to establish a democratic country because generally, not always, but generally, they are more stable countries. And in terms of peacekeeping and so forth, I know that's controversial because, you know, we've lost quite a few soldiers now in Afghanistan. Is it worth the price? Well, I think so far, sir, yes. And we may disagree, and that's fine. But I do. I think our intervention in recent years in the Solomons and NH Timor, again, were appropriate. And I know John Howard was scared to hell that we would lose troops in East Timor. We didn't. I know we didn't. But we very easily could have. And who here would stand up and say we shouldn't have sent troops to East Timor?
Libby.
I'm sure there are some idealistic Australian troops in Afghanistan. And while the official reason, you know, was to stop terrorism, we never had time to have a public debate about what is the best way to stop terrorism. Instead, we had the federal government rushing to support the American and NATO intervention. And, of course, Bob Brown repeatedly tried to get the Australian commitment to Iraq and Afghanistan debated in Parliament, but the government, John Howard, flatly refused to even have a parliamentary debate about the commitment of those forces. And I think that's a tragedy for Australians and for our democracy. Obviously, the best way to stop terrorism is to build a world based on greater international security. And the Greens, of course, have a commitment to working towards greater disarmament. And, of course, again, we do have good examples. The Australian commitment to the Solomon Islands, there have indeed been good peacekeeping initiatives that Australia has supported that show the way that we could pursue. You know, the Solomons just had so many foreign weaponry imported into that country and, you know, it's the big questions that neither major party seem to want to take on because they don't want to look idealistic because everybody's so cynical and everybody's appealing to the lowest common denominator. But there's actually a really strong international record on the kind of things you could do to build a more secure world, and that's what we have to do. And we have to do it even if you don't want to be decent about it. The fact is that governments love, you know, they love, prime ministers love saluting the troops, but they really hate paying for veterans. And that was all I was going to add to that question about the Vietnam veteran. We're still paying for that war. We're still paying for World War II. But governments never want to admit how much gets spent on taking care of the veterans long term. The veterans budget is usually hidden amidst lots of other figures because the veteran organisations are always asking about it. And I can tell you that the oral history work that I've done talking to the wives of veterans is the constant battle, no matter which war you talk about, the constant battle the families always have trying to get decent treatment post-events. And that's the kind of debate we needed to have before we committed to Afghanistan. There are genuinely important issues in Afghanistan. I don't think we should just exit without a strategy. We need to, that's the responsibility of the Australian government, is to start having serious talks with NATO and the US so that the civilians aren't harmed, particularly the women and girls for whom when the Western forces withdraw, who knows what will end up in Afghanistan. So we need to start being... I think the original commitment was wrong. But we are there, and we now have to be responsible about how we exit that country.
Thanks, Libby. And Claire, you've got your own microphone there. That's okay.
I always find these questions particularly difficult, David, because I am a pacifist and I've made that statement in Parliament, so it makes it difficult to talk on issues of war. But in terms of your question, which is about human rights, we absolutely have a responsibility in terms of looking at human rights issues in other countries. It's very difficult as a single government, and I think Libby's points about an international responsibility are true. By the way, we did have a debate in Parliament about the Iraq War, and it was quite an extensive debate. But in terms of... No, it was before the commitment, and in terms of process, it, unfortunately, the Senate actually voted against the Iraq War, but the troops are already on their way, but we hadn't already committed as a government. So, but it just so it happens. In terms of process, I think we must speak out about human rights. We have a history of doing that. There are ways of doing it, though, in terms of how powerful you can be as a single government talking to another government about human rights issues in their country. And we have had recent experiences where it has been very difficult. And when you look at the issues around Sri Lanka and also around things that are happening in the Israel-Palestinian situation, individual governments have spoken, and we as a nation have actually spoken to the governments involved in those areas. But whether that has the appropriate impact, I don't believe it does. I think we need to have a wider international response again, so that it's more voices speaking out about which those things that we see are abuses of human rights. That is the case in Afghanistan, and our commitment in Afghanistan is actually part of not just a personal commitment from our country, it's an international commitment there. So we are not making decisions alone on our role in Afghanistan. It's also part about the general approach in that country. But I think that there needs to be very careful scrutiny about what's happening in that country, and the role of the current government needs to be under examination, so it's not seen that our particular military support, which is clearly to ensure that people are safe and that the incursions by the Taliban are not stronger, if we are not seeing an effective, democratic and sensitive government in place, what are we supporting? So in terms of our ongoing process, it's making sure that those questions continue to be asked.
Thank you very much. That is the end of the questions, and I'm going to invite you to express appreciation to Claire Moore, Libby Connors, Brett Mason and Wendy Francis. As always in these things, there are more questions left than answers. There are things that haven't been addressed. There are issues we've just glossed over and things that we haven't even acknowledged, but we hope that this has been informative and stimulating in terms of your own thinking about the issues and hearing what the different parties think and what their policy directions are. As we close, I'm going to ask the Anglican Dean, Peter Catt, to close in prayer for us.
Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. You lavish the gift of life upon us. We give you thanks for the fragile creature we call democracy. We pray for all who take part in this election, for the people of this nation, for the candidates, their advisers, the members of the media. May all be blessed with the gifts of integrity and discernment, wisdom, clarity of thought and dedication. We offer you this prayer through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you. Part two, if you're interested, is St Paul's Uniting Church, Stafford on Webster Road at 6:30 for 7 o'clock, same time next Monday night, the 9th of August. Hope we'll see some of you there again, and we'll look forward to seeing at least a couple of our people from the panel there tonight there again. Thank you again for coming. Good night.